Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is Jane Arana, investing and small business reporter. And coming up, the great tech share wobble as Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust slumps 25%. We ask if the shine has come off the likes of Tesla et al., or is this just a bump in the road? Should investors be concerned, or is this an opportunity? Also today, the recovery could be female, according to Small Business Britain. Jane has been chatting to some top female founders for International Women's Day, plus GDP figures, trust versus fund. Would you fix your mortgage until 2061? And forget a pint and a bag of port scratchings. I'll have the pub, please, landlord. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we got the latest GDP figures for the first month of the year, 2.9%, leaving the UK economy 9% smaller than its pre-pandemic peak. But Simon, not as bad as expected. Is that the best we can say about it?
Yes. I mean, in normal times, it would be awful. But at the moment, it's not actually that bad. So 2.9% December, January, forecasts were for 4.9%. So that's quite a substantial improvement on a shrinkage of 4.9%, even if 2.9% fall is pretty bad for GDP. And it's also a fraction of the 18.3% collapse that we saw in April last year, which was when lockdown one started, in essence, in full force, and the last time schools were ordered to close. So, I mean, obviously, the lockdown that we entered into in January, certainly in January, was a lot more stringent than the little fun one that we had in November. The kids weren't at school, and don't underestimate the ability of that to crimp a large number of people's ability to do work to their full productive level. But if you think about it, there's a lot of businesses that totally shut down almost this time last year when lockdown started, and this time around continued. So for example, when lockdown was announced at the end of March last year, construction completely shut down. Construction continued this time around. Businesses that had been told to close their doors were sat there thinking, right, what do we do? How do we sell anybody anything? And people were deeply, deeply fearful because it was the unknown, and the unknown always presents the greatest of fears. Whereas this time round, they'd been living with it for 10 months by the time lockdown came in January. So they'd got round to the concept of, yeah, okay, actually, I will go to the supermarket and things like that. Whereas first time round, people were freaking out about going to the supermarket, and you couldn't get a delivery slot, and people worried about where they were going to get food and so on and so on. So you can see, once you put all of those things together, why it didn't shrink by 18.3% as it did first time round. But still, 2.9 is better than 4.9. What are we going to see in February? Probably better than January. And then probably maybe a return to growth in March, perhaps. So we're probably going to get a fall in GDP for the quarter. But because we dodged a fall in GDP in the final quarter of 2021, we won't get a double dip recession yet. And if things continue along on the government's roadmap as planned, we shouldn't get another quarter of falling GDP in the second quarter of 2021. And so we'll avoid a double digit recession then. Although, as we all know, we're not out of the woods yet, either on coronavirus, lockdown, or the damage done to the economy and the bill that is going to have to be settled at some point, maybe a long time into the future when we've decided to stop printing lots of money.
Yeah, indeed. I was just about to sort of focus on perhaps some of the positives there, but you brought me down a peg or two, Simon. Now, Jane, we did get some better figures in terms of unemployment predictions. We've had GDP figures out today, better than expected. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a fool. I do appreciate this is not brilliant, but actually, we've had a few podcasts where we've got a bit gloomy, haven't we, Simon? Were we wrong? And actually, we're going to have the bounce afterwards that everybody talks about, that coiled spring.
Yeah, it's one of those things where sort of everything went down. Hopefully the only way is up. People are feeling a lot more confident now. We've got the roadmap to recovery announced. It's been a year of this madness. I think people are just thinking it can't get any worse. And now that we've got some kind of plan in place, they're getting a bit more confident. Over the last year, we have seen, sadly, a lot of businesses fail or lose massive amounts of income. But we've also seen a lot of businesses being created or booming, pivoting and finding other ways to survive, really. And a lot of small businesses that I've spoken to in particular have found new ways to make an income, but they've been so successful that they're going to carry them on.
It's interesting you talk about speaking to small businesses, because you've actually been speaking to some female founders. We, of course, had International Women's Day this week. And actually, the picture's really, financially speaking, not been great for women, generally speaking, obviously. Before coronavirus, we have things like, you know, the gender pay gap, the whatever people think about the way that that's reported, et cetera, et cetera. The pensions gap, investing gap, and the fact that a lot of women work in areas which have been badly hit by the pandemic. But the green shoots of positivity, the support network Small Business Britain thinks actually female-owned businesses could be central to our economic recovery. They've done some research. They say 1 in 5 women are considering starting their own business this year. That's quite a substantial figure. Why do you think that's the case?
You're right. You know, women have found it difficult over the pandemic. Even before that, I've been writing about female founders for a while now. And I think it's just a harder environment in general, you know, trying to get funding. A lot of female founders that I've spoken to, the kinds of areas that they're the project that they're offering is sometimes not relatable, and a lot of investors are generally men. So for example, I spoke to Tanya Bola, the founder of LV, which is a Kegel trainer. I remember her telling me, you know, she put that product in front of male investors and they didn't even want to touch it. Like, they heard what it was about. Yeah, so.
Kegel trainer.
it's a little device that you put inside you to train your Kegel muscles. It's really important. It's when you're about to have a baby, you know, you're told to train your Kegel muscles, but people just don't know about it because it's one of those sort of taboo topics. And I remember her telling me, it was really hard to get that off the ground and to find investment for it.
Like, and floor muscles? Or...
Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay, that's for a few. Okay, yeah, I mean, that's something that we've been speaking about for a long time, investment. But, you know, this is a bright spot. This is a positivity. Whether those 1 in 5 women are going to build businesses, there is something about the opportunities that, you know, working from home and pivoting, starting businesses, the emphasis on small business as well, has given perhaps women inspiration, a spur to kind of drive?
Yeah, one of the things that really sort of held women back before, unfortunately, was, and especially mothers, was, you know, not being able to sort of juggle that family work balance. But I've definitely seen the more sort of working from home has given them more time, more energy to think of other things, to do other things while they're at home. A lot of budding entrepreneurs have realised they've now got the time to sort of focus a bit more on that side hustle that they've been thinking about for years. They're reading about other entrepreneurs that are struggling and what they're doing to get ahead. And there's been a lot of small business networks, such as Small Business Britain, such as Enterprise Nation, the Federation of Small Businesses. They're doing so much to help people that are struggling. I think people that have always thought about finding their own business are now looking at those services as well to think, okay, everything's a bit rubbish at the moment, but maybe this is my chance to get in. The last crisis we saw, 2008-2009, a lot of new businesses were launched then, and a lot of people I've spoken to have said we could be seeing a repeat of that.
Simon, your view, we've spoken a lot about the changes that could have happened to the workplace, to businesses. Are we all going to work from home? And actually, you know, listening to some of the noises might not be as big a change in the future as we expected. What's your view?
I think that you will get more working from home. I don't think that we will switch to an entirely working from home model, and I don't think that the vast majority of people would want to do that. But I think there was a survey done, an interesting survey by Deloitte this week, and people said that they'd like to go back to the office 2 days a week. They see that as a way of spending some time where they can speak to their colleagues and catch up with their colleagues and get in on what's going on, network, all that kind of stuff. And then also have that balance of being at home and, you know, maybe not wasting. I mean, if you're lucky, you probably spend 2 hours a day commuting. A lot of people spend 3 hours, you know, round trip and so on. it just makes their life a lot more flexible. Whether businesses are going to come on board with that or not is another matter. There will be some businesses who have say, well, actually, you don't have to come back into the office. I have friends who work for major businesses who have been told, we don't ever expect you back in the office. Or you'll have some businesses that say, we want you back in the office full time. Or maybe you'll have some that go, hang on a minute, let's think about this. This is a very easy and cheap way to keep a lot of our staff happy and make our staff happier. And in fact, it saves us money while we're doing it. Maybe if we just tell them they can work from home 2 days a week, then that's beneficial to them and it's beneficial to us. And I think that that middle ground is somewhere where you'll find most businesses coming down on, but it'll be a spectrum, be some at one end and some at another. Where I think there's the interesting opportunity for new businesses and productivity gains and things like that is it is now far more acceptable to do things digitally. There's this talk of 5 years in 1 year that we've talked about before, that the past year has seen an adaptation of technology and digital ways of working and remote working that would have maybe taken 5 years, and it's been forced to be done in 1 year. Now that means that you can maybe do things that you didn't used to be able to do, and it's going to be easier. And that does feed into some of the stuff around entrepreneurs, female entrepreneurs as well, people who run their own business. Because the fact of the matter is that in many cases, more of the burden of childcare and family life, etc., will fall to the female, to the woman in the relationship. Rightly or wrongly, that's just what happens. And you know, you can say, and in many cases, that's what a lot of people want. I mean, I know a lot of, you know, my own wife runs her own business, and she doesn't want to not spend. She doesn't want to do that all of the time, flat out, to the point that she doesn't get to spend any time being a mum whilst our children are young. Okay. Now, I mean, likewise, I don't want to spend my time working flat out, so I don't get any time to be a dad. But you know, but it is the fact that she doesn't want to do that. And so you do get the scenario where people can do stuff from home. If you can do you can do the meetings from home, you can do the things that you would have had to travel somewhere previously to do. So whereas previously it might have taken you half a day to go and spend an hour or an hour and a half doing something, or meeting someone, or pitching, or looking for investment, or speaking to a product designer for what you're launching, or something like that, you can now do that in an hour and a half from your home. And then when the time comes that you actually do need to go meet them, hopefully one day you'll be allowed to meet people again, you can go meet them. So I think there are big opportunities for productivity gains there. I think there are big opportunities for people who can capitalize on it. And we've seen, as Jane has said, loads of stories of people coming up with great ideas over the last year. And Jane did an interview with Peter Hargreaves, one of the founders of Hargreaves Lansdown, not so long ago. And he said that he thought that we were going to see loads of great businesses come out of the pandemic, because like many successful business people and entrepreneurs, he said the best time to start a business is in a downturn, in a recession. And lots of the ideas, you know, going back to what we're talking about, female founders, the International Women's Day earlier this week and so on, you know, lots of those businesses have come from female founders. We've had some great ideas coming out of there. Jane wrote a story recently about someone who's invented a sociable a bottle for taking your wine out on your socials, basically.
Partner in
so,
wine.
Partner in wine, that's the one. Yeah, so basically you're heading out. Mm. Soon you'll be allowed to.
Yeah.
You were able to briefly. It's going to be the summer of having to do stuff outdoors. And until we get through till quite late on, that might have to be outdoors in a public space. Or you might not even have a garden, you know, or a lot of it is a public space. People might not want to come around to your garden. So it's like you go out, you've got your flask. What do? Do you just like, it's taking the wine bottle is a bit awkward. But if you decant it in a plastic bottle, that's not so nice. Or do you just use like your metal bottle? No, you've got a special one for your wine. I think you've got loads of ideas like this, but you know, things that will catch on. My point is
I'm
that basically
more on board with that idea than the muscles thing. I'll be telling you this with you.
Yeah, but to be honest, like overall, like a more long term, there's going to be more long term need for a business that involves like women dealing with problems with their pelvic floor than there is with drinking wine in parks. I don't know, maybe wine in parks is going to be a big thing for years to come. but anyway, my point is, there's lots of ideas that are going to come out of this. And actually, it's got easier, ironically, at a time when it's got much harder to do a lot of stuff, it's got easier to do some of the things involved in entrepreneurship and starting a business. Mm-hmm. And we have seen a huge amount of entrepreneurial thinking and pivoting from existing businesses as well. One of the reasons why I feel so sorry for the pubs and the restaurants is the sheer amount of effort and thought that they put into making themselves what they were told was COVID secure by the government, only to then be shut down again. But they're in a good position to have that all up and running for when they can open their doors to the outside on April the 12th and things. And my glass is half full. I think there's a lot of opportunity out there. And I think that the economy is going to do very well once it finally reopens. So, you know, that we will see a surge in activity. And as we spoke about last week, it's whether we get the escape velocity that we get out, that it's not just a rebound, that it's something that becomes a virtuous circle and it lasts.
It's interesting you talk about, I mean, we jest about the two products there, but actually there's a point. How much of the new businesses' ideas are going to be for the short term new worlds that we might get, and how much is going to be sort of long-term future planning? As an investor, that's something you need to think about. And we've seen this with tech, right? And I'm going to go here now, because last year Tesla powering ahead, proving a lifeline for savers. Bright start to 2021. Tech stocks, though, including the electric vehicle giant, have since had a pretty bumpy ride. The impact of that means that several investment trusts, which Tesla remains a major holding, including Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust and Baillie Gifford US Growth Trust, have suffered too. So what's going on, and should investors be concerned at the moment? Jaina, what's been happening to tech and growth stocks? A bit of an economics 101 on this one.
Sure. Yeah, so there have been a lot of concerns about inflation lately and interest rates rising, which has led to a mass sell-off of US government bonds or treasuries, which has in turn seen yields go up. Rising long-term bond yields, that's not great for growth stocks. It makes them less appealing as they're valued according to high future expected earnings. Of course, within growth, you've got all the tech stocks. You've got, you know, Tesla, Amazon, Apple. They all fell down recently. They had a great run last year, you know, especially everyone working from home using things like Zoom and Microsoft. But what goes up must come down. And we've seen a bit of volatility recently. Tesla went nuts last year, rose by, I think, 300%, possibly a lot higher.
That's an important point, because as much as there's been a drop, I think it's about 20%, actually, they're still way up, right?
Yeah. And same with the trusts, you know, Scottish Mortgage, the UK's, if not the biggest, investment trust. It fell by 25% up until the 5th of March, year to date, up until 5th of March. But it was up about 80% over the last year. So, you know, it's gone down a bit, but overall investors are probably still very happy with their returns. And since then, since the 5th of March, it's back up again, 15%.
So yes, the old roller coaster, as everybody likes to call it. But Simon, is it just a little bump in the road? A wee blip? Are we down in the roller coaster? Or actually, do you expect these falls to continue? Especially Tesla, because that's an interesting one.
Tesla is a law unto itself, and Elon Musk is a law unto himself. He was briefly the world's richest man, and then not the world's richest man again when his company's share price fell. And it just shows how much of Elon Musk has invested in Tesla. They are, you know, essentially the same thing, Elon and Tesla. Tesla's an interesting one, because it's very difficult to understand what Tesla has to do to justify the valuation being put on its share price and how much those shares have risen or did rise last year. And it was at one point a very large holding within Scottish Mortgage, which is one of the UK's most popular investment trusts. It's growth orientated. It invests in the companies that it thinks are changing the world effectively. The companies that are going to be the ones that are shaping the world in 5 or 10 years' time. As they are growth investors, they're not particularly concerned about whether profits now justify the price that they are paying. It's the ability to make those profits consistently, year in, year out, grow them, beat expectations, change the world in the future that they are investing in. But it's not just like throw some darts at the wall kind of stuff. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of research and a lot of expertise that goes into this. I interviewed one of the managers. There's two managers, Tom Slater and James Anderson. I interviewed Tom Slater maybe five weeks ago on the investing show, and asked him about Tesla. And he said, look, we are long-term investors in Tesla. We have been long-term investors in Tesla. And what you have to remember is that for a lot of that period of time, Tesla was getting grief. You know, they were getting grief for being long-term investors in Tesla. And yes, they have made spectacular returns on it over the past year or so. But that has come after many years of reasons for holding Tesla being very seriously questioned by many people. And then it suddenly changed around and Tesla's share prices went up through the roof. Now it's fallen. Now, Scottish Mortgage had actually already been selling down some of its Tesla shares. In some instances, it's because of the rise in Tesla shares, it had become too big a chunk of the investment trust. So at one point, it was like nearly 10% of the trust. And then they'd sold it down. So it's still like the biggest holding, but it was about 5%. But that's still quite a lot to be exposed to. But then they're exposed to lots of other things around the world. Now, what we've seen is the NASDAQ, which is the US growth company index, seen as the bellwether for them. At one point, that was down 10%, and it's down 4% at the moment on its peak. So the NASDAQ went into correction territory. People are just waiting for this to happen because of the very high valuations being placed on these companies. But maybe those valuations are worth it. Maybe the world is changing. Maybe we're underestimating how much the world is changing. And actually, those companies are just going to go from strength to strength to strength. There was a time when people said similar things about Facebook and about Amazon. There was a time when Microsoft was considered a busted flush. It was done for. It was yesterday's tech. It was old news. Microsoft shares have gone on an absolute tear in recent years if you'd invested in them. Or maybe they're not the companies of the future. But the thing about investing with an investment trust like Scottish Mortgage is you're investing into lots of those different companies. They're spreading their bets. They might have some big holdings in there, but they're invested in companies around the world. Yes, all of them tend to share a digital element to their business. But Tom Slater was very keen to point out that they all do very, very different things. So if we think about these businesses, and they all get lumped in together, and these aren't just Scottish Mortgage shareholdings, but we lump in, you know, Tesla, Netflix, Facebook, Amazon, Google. In this country, we're about to see Deliveroo IPO and things like that. We lump all of that stuff in together, but they don't all do the same thing. Tesla makes cars and a lot of money off carbon credits that dealing in those which other car makers buy. But Tesla makes cars. Amazon sells stuff. It's the world's biggest shop and also has Amazon Web Services, which basically is what the internet is built on at the moment and powers the internet. It's the cloud servers and stuff like that. Facebook is the world's biggest social media platform, but effectively it's a huge advertising business. Netflix has become the modern day equivalent of like a Hollywood studio kind of thing, but a Hollywood studio combined with an extremely sticky subscription business. Deliveroo or Just Eat or Delivery Hero or any of those companies that are in the delivery space, they deliver food to people. They make it easier for small businesses, effectively, a lot of them are small businesses, to make food and sell it to people. And then they take a little cut in the middle kind of thing. So they all do different things. They're not all exactly the same company. Now, whether their share prices are all moving in the same direction due to the sentiment underlying it and the fact that there's a lot of money washing around and people have a lot of money to chuck at stuff. And one minute everybody's chasing growth and the next minute everybody goes, "Ooh, I think growth might be finished. Maybe we need to shift value," and the money just chases that way. The old watching a team of children playing football and they all run around the pitch after the ball in one direction and then they all run around the pitch after the ball in the other direction. And I think we need to give an honorary mention to the fact that somebody paid $69.5 million for an NFT yesterday, which is a sort of piece of digital crypto art. There's only one of them in the world, but it is on a computer, and that is £50 million. Indicates that there might be quite a lot of money sloshing around the world at the moment. And so with some of these high growth, high expectation companies, you might be seeing the prices get a little bit high.
Jenny, your view? What should we be doing here? If you're a little bit worried. Should we be worried?
I think in terms of... So with Scottish Mortgage, it's one of the best performing trusts for the last decade. So the big question here was, you know, was it an opportunity when it fell down? Mm. And I'm actually kicking myself that I didn't go into it on the day that it all went down, because it's already gone up 15% since then. I don't think it's anything to worry about. Obviously, past performance is not an indicator of future performance, as they always say. Okay. But I think there's still a lot to go with. And Simon mentioned Amazon Web Services. There is so much more to be done with that. It's not even started yet. I think there's a lot of potential and a lot of opportunity in tech, in growth. I do think this little blip is just that. It is just a blip.
I think the important thing to remember is that old saying about eggs and baskets, right? Mm-hmm. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Now, if you have invested all of your money with Scottish Mortgage, despite the fact that Scottish Mortgage spreads your money around a lot of different companies, you might have all your eggs in one basket. I don't think that the managers of Scottish Mortgage would tell you that you should invest all of your money with Scottish Mortgage. As proud as they are of their investment trust, I think they'd probably say you might want to hold some other investments as well, so that you have a diversified and balanced portfolio. The thing to watch out for, of course, is that when you have an investment that's done so well that it suddenly takes up a big chunk of your portfolio. So you might not have deliberately set out to have 50% of your portfolio invested in Scottish Mortgage, but Scottish Mortgage might have done so well that you now have 50% of it in there. Maybe you're an individual share investor and you didn't set out to have 60% of your portfolio made up of Tesla, and all of a sudden 60% of your portfolio is made up of Tesla, and you buy into the argument that it's not just a car company, it's changing energy and battery storage and all these other things. But you still think, hang on a minute, 60% one company, that's too much. You need to spread your money around. And so whether these growth companies deliver, whether that was an opportunity, whether it was a warning sign, whatever it was, the thing to remember is don't put all your eggs in one basket. And it's just as simple as that. And don't diversify by just buying another 5 growth-orientated investment trusts that will move in the same direction. That's still having all your eggs in one basket, just to be clear.
Again, sound advice, Simon. Thank you. I just want to talk about investment trusts, actually, because, Jane, you've done an article recently, new data from Interactive Investor, finding that the average investment trust has beaten its fund equivalent on return since 2000. But, always a few buts, it may be harder to find a bargain at the moment, getting a share of a basket of assets for less than their total value. So just tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, investment trusts have, since 2000, performed better than investment funds. The average global investment trust outperformed the average global fund by almost 1% a year on average over the last decade. Not saying trusts are better than funds. I think, as we just mentioned, in terms of stocks, you know, diversification is key. It's important to hold a mix of stocks and funds and trusts, etc. But trusts have generally performed better. They're more known for sort of long-term investing. You don't have to worry about daily flows. You can just sort of buy and hold. Even better, if you buy a trust on a discount to NAV, that's where the share price is lower than the net asset value of the portfolio's holdings, then you could make even more money if that discount shrinks. Or if it moves to a premium, so the share price is worth more than the holdings, you've got yourself a bargain there. What Interactive Investor is saying is there aren't many trusts trading on discounts at the moment. So while you can still make money when performance goes up, those so-called bargains are probably harder to come by. Most trusts in sort of the most popular sectors, global, UK equity income, a lot of them are trading on very small but still premiums at the moment. You're finding discounts in areas such as commercial property, but I think a lot of people are avoiding that area at the moment.
Simon, your view on that?
I think it's interesting, and I think that investment trusts have some advantages. And the reason why I like investment trusts is because they can't be forced buyers or forced sellers. So by the fact that they are limited in the number of shares, unlike an investment fund where when money rushes in, the fund manager has a load of money that they then need to find a way to invest, and they can effectively be a forced buyer. And when money rushes out, they have a load of money that they need to suddenly find, and they can become a forced seller, like Mr. Woodford famously did recently, I think is an advantage. I think the fact they have an independent board keeping tabs on the fund manager that can sack the fund manager is a very positive thing. And some of those boards do really keep tabs on the fund manager and sack the fund manager. Some of them don't do the greatest job, like the one of Woodford Patient Capital Trust, featuring aforementioned fund manager. They can hold over money in the good times to help pay dividends in the bad times. They can also borrow money with gearing, which can magnify returns, but that can also magnify losses. And they just, there's a little bit less of the shiny glossiness to them, the chasing whatever the latest fad is, that exists in the investment fund world. And I'm stupid enough to think that not only can active managers beat the market, but that I can pick the active managers who will beat the market, despite all the evidence to the contrary. So so I like investment trusts, and so it's always nice to see something that confirms your thoughts and that they've done better than the funds. But you know, will that continue? I don't know. It's, you know, it's always nice to read something that confirms your thoughts, isn't it? But the most dangerous thing to read is something that confirms your thoughts. I thought it was really interesting that the one that they didn't beat in was UK smaller companies, because you'd kind of expect that to be an area where they would beat in, because it's kind of a liquid market. It's one where having that time and space and the investment trust structure would pay off. And I think that just goes to show that it's always dangerous to read something that confirms your thoughts.
But it's always nice anyway. Yeah. Your ego gets a little boost. Right. I don't know about you, and we're talking about like long-term things here, but I don't barely know what I'm doing next week, let alone in 40 years time. But that's how long a new mortgage will last that's coming onto the market. Touted as Britain's longest ever fixed rate home loan, the product from Habito One will allow home buyers to stay on the same rate until 2061. As strange as this sounds, it's pretty normal in places such as the US and Netherlands, but will it catch on here? Simon, the details first, and then your view.
So effectively, this is a mortgage that lets you fix your rate for the life of the mortgage. Okay, so it's like a lifetime fix. Now, the thing that we honed in on, and everybody else honed in on, obviously, is that 40 years. You could fix it for 40 years. So 2061, right? I mean, who knows what we're going to be doing in 2061? Hopefully we'll be out of lockdown. But if you go back 40 years, you will find a year in which Charles and Diana got married. Happy times, happy royal wedding times. Ian Botham performed his Ashes heroics at Headingley. I know you'll approve of that, Georgie. Arthur Scargill was elected president of the National Union of Mine Workers. And the specials reached number one in the charts with Ghost Town. I picked that out for my column because it was better than Buck's Fizz and making your mind up. That's a long time ago, isn't it? 40 years. You'd have also been highly unlikely to find a bank or building society that would give you a 40-year mortgage term back then. Certainly not a fix. Mm-hmm. But you could be that much into the future, just finishing your Habito mortgage, where you've perhaps got a 4.85% fixed rate. Now, there's two things to unpick here. Three things, really. Firstly, Habito were very keen to stress that you don't have to take a 40-year mortgage. This is just offered up to 40 years. It could be 25 years, for example, a more normal mortgage term. And that allays some of the concerns of people like me who think 40-year mortgages are a bad thing. This creep of mortgage terms to longer and longer and longer to fit people into affordability brackets and get them through affordability tests that just feeds into keeping house prices high is a bad scene. But unfortunately, it's what a lot of people have to do to buy a home. I blame the banks, not the people buying the homes. Secondly, 4.85%. Now, you don't necessarily need to know the ins and outs of the mortgage market to think that sounds a bit spicy compared to a base rate of 0.1%. And just to outline where that stands, that would be for a 15% deposit mortgage. So if you think about the fact that people most likely to be taking this out might be a first-time buyer, right? Okay, so maybe they've made 15% deposit. That's a pretty decent deposit. It's not a huge deposit though, so they might be a bit wary. They might think, yeah, I like the idea of the security of fixing for life. So 4.85%. You would be paying roughly 2.6% on a five-year fix by comparison. And that's still a pretty nice, secure, I know what my mortgage is going to be for 5 years, right? Now, the difference on a mortgage could be £800 a month to £570 a month, right? And over 5 years, that's an extra £13,800 you're paying for the security of knowing that your rate will remain the same for another 35 years after that. Now, you don't have an early repayment charge, so you could leave at any time. But the attraction of that to most people is the fact they could leave at any time if rates get cheaper, not they could leave at any time if rates get more expensive, because then you'd stick with where you are. But are you willing to pay the front-loaded extra cost of this mortgage for the security in the future? It's a gamble. You might be. You might sit there one day, the base rate's back at 6%, mortgage rate's 9%. You're rubbing your hands and going, I am a smart bunny. Or it might be that interest rates take forever to get anywhere near back to what were considered a relatively low level not so many years ago. And you spend the next 40 years or 25 years or however long you decide to fix for paying an over the odds mortgage rate and thinking, I probably shouldn't have gone for that mortgage. The idea behind long-term fixed rates is great. And it's to try to bring some stability into the market, take some of the risk out of Britain's property market casino, get rid of the short-termism rampant in our two-year fix obsessed mortgage market, which is still the most popular mortgage term, two-year fix. 5 years are very popular now, but 2 years is still the most popular. 2 years goes very quickly. You're increasing the risk, financial risk to yourself. Banks are actually increasing financial risk themselves as well, but they make money on the fees, and the mortgage brokers make money on the fees as well and the commission, so nobody really worries about that. But you've got to convince people to think very, very long term. And I highlighted in my column that I think one of the problems with convincing people to think very, very long term is, as you said earlier, past performance is no guarantee of future gains. But people look to the past and they extrapolate that and they decide that what has happened in the past is going to continue to happen into the future or continue to happen in some way. And just to give you a potted history of Simon Lambert and family's mortgage life, in 15 years that I've had mortgages on my own homes, the last 15 years, in 2006, I started with a five-year fix at 4.99%. In 2011, I shifted to a five-year flexible tracker mortgage at 2.75%. Now, I fully expected to have to leave that tracker mortgage before the end of the term was up. There were no charges to do so because I thought the interest rates were going to go up. They didn't. And I moved to a lifetime tracker offset mortgage, again, another tracker mortgage, at 2.74% in 2014. Now, this was done because I wanted to have an offset mortgage because so I could set savings and stuff against it and save some money. Now, that actually did get cheaper at one point after the Brexit vote. Rates were cut before they went up. They did then go up briefly. And so I did end up paying a slightly higher rate on the tracker for like 18 months or so, but that was cushioned by the offset. And then I got rid of that when we sold our flat in March last year. And then when we bought our new house in summer, I took out a five-year fixed rate mortgage at 1.4%. So my first five-year fix was at 4.99. My most recent five-year fix was at 1.4%. That money at 4.99% was considered really cheap at the time. Actually, for a while afterwards, it did turn out to be because interest rates went up for a bit after that. But I think the picture that I'm trying to paint there is not my mortgages. It's that lots of people have this experience of seeing rates go down, go down, go down, go down, go down. And they're just going to expect them to either maybe not continue to go down, because it's difficult to see how they could go any further down, but they're going to expect to see them not go up by that much. So can you convince people to pay a couple of hundred pound a month extra to insure themselves against the fact that they might go up when they look in the rearview mirror and go, well, they've only gone down so far? I'm not convinced.
Yeah, that's one question. Can you do it? But also, sort of, should you do it? Who does this appeal to, realistically speaking? Who wants this?
The government?
I mean,
no, genuinely, the government said they wanted to encourage more long-term... The government genuinely said they wanted to encourage more long-term fixed-rate mortgages. It would be a good thing. I think the problem is there's no competition in this market. There's Habito, and there's another new mortgage lender coming to market called Perenna that's going to launch these. But other than this, the longest you can get is a 15-year fix. Hardly anybody takes a 15-year fix. 10-year fixes are a bit more popular, a bit more common, but it's still a very niche product. But if you just look at how much interest has shifted from a 2% to a 5-year fix, you can see that people would like to think long term. And Britain's mortgage market is an aberration, in many senses. There are many places where you have longer term fixed rate mortgages. If you go take a short hop across the channel to France, you will find many, many mortgages that are, you know, fixed or set on a basis for the lifetime of that mortgage. And I do think that it would be good to shift away from the situation we're in now. And hopefully, I wish Habito all the luck in the world with this mortgage, because they are trying to do something different. And I think that's interesting. If we could just build up a bit more of a head of steam and some competition and some stuff that gets the rates down and everything like that, then maybe they would become more popular. But at this kind of level, I'm struggling to see how many people are going to choose it.
Jaina, briefly, a fan, would you?
Rates and costs aside, it's a bit of a big ask, right? I was talking to my boyfriend about this last night, actually. He's a mortgage advisor. It wasn't just our pillow talk.
I'm making no judgment.
He said, obviously they're appealing to first-time buyers, to younger people. They're not going to ask sort of a middle-aged person to think about that. But we don't really like to be tied down. We subscribe to Netflix knowing that we can leave at any time that we want.
Whether we do or not,
everything's been streamed. He said he recommends 2-year fixed mortgages, like 5-year at a push, because people don't just want to stay where they are at the moment. Everyone's constantly moving. You know, it's not just the mortgage market. It's obviously right now we can't travel, but everyone wants to move around. It's a bit much asking someone to be tied down for 40 years.
It does seem to me a sort of not regressive step. I don't mean that in introducing it as regressive, but more for a life that perhaps we're less likely to lead. We're much more transient now, I think.
But the key to that is that you can leave this mortgage at any time and you can take it with you. That's the idea, isn't it?
Oh,
but the thing is, you're probably going to...
The
issue with portability of mortgages is that when you move home, you can take it with you, but you need to get your lender to agree to your new home for a start. And secondly, you're probably going to need to borrow some more money. Most people move up the ladder. You're then tied to borrowing that extra bit of money from the same lender, because lenders don't like people taking a mortgage out with another lender on the same property. That tends to be so prohibitively expensive that there is no point doing it. So it's not as easy necessarily as it sounds and as you think, but you can leave and you can leave and you can take it with you. That is the advantage.
All right, from buying houses to buying pubs. Even with our roadmap out of lockdown, the industry set to open its doors to a very thirsty, perhaps not so thirsty, we did at home, but thirsty to go out, I think. Public once more, it is feared it might be too late for many locals. The same is true, of course, for community hubs, theatres, sporting organisations. But does the answer lie in community ownership? We got something in the budget related to this from Rishi. How will it work in practice?
We have a community fund. And this is to help people buy shares in their local pub, which I think is a good idea. And not from an investment perspective, just to be clear. I don't think you're going to be seeing Tesla rivaling returns from your local pub. But from the point of view of having a share in something that is a community asset, and also from the point of view that there are unfortunately going to be an awful lot of pubs that don't reopen. There is a huge risk to these things that people value hugely and are the center of, you know, village or local life still, you know, from the fact that they have been ordered to shut their doors for a large amount of the past year. They've got some help, but many of them have lost large amounts of money. And there are major concerns that a lot of the pubs are not going to reopen. Or they're going to reopen and they're going to shut again soon after. So the £150 million Community Ownership Fund has been launched by Rishi in order to help people get involved in trying to raise money to buy their local pub. Now, the difficulty is that trying to buy your local pub is expensive. And why is trying to buy your local pub expensive? Well, because it's worth so much as a property if somebody converts it into a house. Pubs have to get permission to be converted into a house, and they have to prove that they cannot be profitable and they cannot be a viable business. What's the best way of proving you can't be a viable business? Not being able to make any money because someone ordered you to shut for the best part of a year. So that's why people are so worried about this. And I guess maybe in some places where, you know, you walk another 100 yards and you fall over another pub, and then you walk another 100 yards and you fall over another pub, people could live with it. But even then, there'll be some of those pubs that close that are the ones that people like the most and value as their local pub. But it's a real issue, you know, in your village or something like that. So people like to try to get together and try to buy the pubs, and they encourage people to put some money in, buy a share in the pub, get involved in running it. And we've spoken to a couple of communities that are trying to do that, and to one that did it. So the way it works is that community groups will be given up to £250,000 to help their struggling pubs in the area, and in exceptional cases up to £1 million matched funding will be available to help establish community-owned sports clubs or sports grounds. It's not only pubs, it could be theatres, shops, local clubs. The full details will emerge. We spoke to some people from a village called Gildon Morden in Cambridgeshire, and they rescued a pub called the Three Tons. And John Harrison, who was the chairman of Gildon Morden Community Pub Limited, owners of said pub, said, "We would have loved it if we could have had that deal, but we're already beyond that stage." So they bought the pub in November 2018 after it had been closed for 6 years. They spent 6 months refurbishing it, and then they leased it to tenants who opened it again in 2019. Total cost in buying the pub was in excess of £400,000. They raised £250,000 in a share issue, got £100,000 in half loan and half grant, and then borrowed the rest from a cooperative and community finance. His advice to other communities considering it was to take the tenanted route. So he said, "From our point of view, having an experienced tenant who was well aligned with community objectives was really helpful. If we'd have tried to run the pub ourselves with all that was going on, it would have been really tough. The choice of tenant is very important. We were fortunate in that the couple who runs the pub for us are very open and cooperative, and they're keen for the pub to be the heart of the community." So that's the thing. It's not just about buying the pub and getting the pub open. It's about having the people to run the pub. And do you really want to be running the pub yourself? Probably not. So if you can get tenants in to run the pub and your vision can be aligned and everything like that, you can have something that's great for the community. We also spoke to villagers Mistley in Essex. They are trying to save the Anchor Inn, the last remaining pub there. The owner has put it up for sale for £425,000, and they're very keen. They're trying to raise money at the moment. And the other people we spoke to are in Marlborough in Wiltshire, and they are trying to rescue the Silks on the Downs pub, which has been closed since March 2020 with no plans to reopen. That the owner approached the community to see if they were keen on buying it, and there are now plans afoot to do so. I think that this would be a really good thing if lots of people could do this. Mm. I'm sure it's fraught with difficulty and the opportunity to fall out with people, Hanforth Parish Council style. But I think it would be a great thing. And, you know, if you live somewhere where you're worried about the pub closing, whether it's the last pub in the village or just one of the pubs that you love in town, then look into this, get together with people. The pubs, it's harder running a pub now than it used to be. But there are very many pubs that have become hugely successful.
I was just thinking, I think I Googled how many were in my village. My town, there's 33. So it's kind of, which one would you pick, I guess? But it sounds a good idea, nonetheless, like you say, if you can avoid the fallings out. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, or a local pub that you fancy buying. Simon? Simon can arrange this for you. I mean, it sounded so you're like sort of pub broker there. Sorry, Simon.
No, but hopefully a pub visitor once restrictions are eased. Yeah. You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.